You open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
And I threw up my hand and I said, what do you mean by genre? And he said, no robots, no trolls, no dragons, no ghosts. And I said, well, what else is there?
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Today, Benjamin Percy tells how his critically acclaimed novel Red Moon began as a sixth grade report on werewolves.
You know, I received a B- on this paper, which is one of the many reasons it feels so good to say, you know, to hold this book in my hand and say, in your face, Mrs. Ziegenhagen.
Benjamin Percy's novel Red Moon transcends the monster fiction genre, transporting the werewolf story to modern America and the War on Terror. His fiction and nonfiction have been read on NPR, performed at Symphony Space, and published in numerous magazines like Esquire. Percy spoke with his friend and fellow writer, Jeremy Chamberlain. Percy starts the discussion talking about his appetite for books as a child.
I grew up in rural Oregon, and we would travel to Portland because we just had this lousy Walden Books in the mall. And we would drive to Portland to Powell's, which is my favorite bookstore in the country. A legendary bookstore, and we would spend the entire afternoon there, and I would build this tower of books, and that would be my story ration for the next few months before we returned to visit my grandparents again. So I spent a summer working at Glacier National Park, and during this time I was the gardener at Glacier National Park, which is kind of a strange thing to be at a national park. I didn't work much.
I would water
the geraniums and mow the lawn once every few weeks.
And this is what impressed your wife. This is what
caught her eye. That's where I met my then girlfriend, now wife, who was also working at the Many Glacier Lodge for the summer as a waitress. And I was writing her all of these lascivious letters and poems. And she said, "You should be a writer." And I said, "Okay." So in a way, it's all been an attempt to impress a pretty girl. And I was, you know, I'd written quite a bit before then, but never seriously. I mean, to become a writer seemed something otherworldly. I'd never met a writer, not until I was in college. And what happened was I walked into that first creative writing classroom, and I sat down eagerly, and then the professor read through the syllabus, and one of the things he said was, "There's no genre permitted in this classroom." And I threw up my hand, and I said, what do you mean by genre? And he said, no robots, no trolls, no dragons, no ghosts. And then I put up my hand again, and he called on me. And I said, but what else is there? And I was very earnest, because up to that point, that's what storytelling was to me.
Yeah.
And I was exposed thereafter to all of these literary writers who I ought to have been reading all along. I had no idea who Raymond Carver was. I didn't know who Alice Munro was. I didn't know who Sherman Alexie was. I didn't know who Tim O'Brien was. And I fell in love with them. But all along, I've sort of straddled those two boundaries because I grew up on genre and then had a literary education. And so I'm sort of neither fish nor fowl for that reason.
Is that a false divide, you think? Why does that exist? Why does the writing instructor walk in and say, no robots, no ghosts, no trolls, no?
Well, I think it's the advent of the MFA program, the Master of Fine Arts program, in the 1960s, the rise of sort of the academization of creative writing has created these normative values where people treasure, above all else, pretty writing and realism. And there's nothing wrong with pretty writing. I love a pretty sentence. But there has been a neglect of story. And story is often associated primarily with genre, propulsive action. And plot is almost a nasty word in a lot of creative writing classrooms. Somebody might throw out an insult that this is plotted fiction. But what is sort of ridiculous about all of that, of course, is that realism is the trend. You know, if you look at the long hoof mark trail of literature, you know, it's been the fantastic all along. And two, if I had sort of a an epiphanic moment, I guess you could say. If my own story was literary, I had an epiphany of my own. When I was in grad school, I picked up this book by Michael Chabon, edited by Michael Chabon, called Thrilling Tales. Mm-hmm. And he had assigned all of these different writers, by and large literary writers, to write. He asked them to write the kind of story that they loved as a kid. So Sherman Alexie writes a zombie story, and Rick Moody writes a dystopic story, and Jim Shepherd writes a story about a giant shark, and it goes on and on. And when I read that book, and when I read particularly his introduction, it made a lot of sense to me. He claimed that he was a bored reader, and a bored writer as well. And I think Michael Chabon has really become a cheerleader for a whole generation of writers, along with Jonathan Lethem. Behind what I've been calling the Avengerization of literature. In that he's saying, look at Shirley Jackson or Poe or Nathaniel Hawthorne writing about The Devil in the Woods and so many others. Or look at some of my favorite writers right now. Look at Margaret Atwood. Look at Kate Atkinson. Look at Cormac McCarthy or Dennis Lehane. Where do they belong? In a bookstore, right? You could say that Cormac McCarthy belongs in horror, a Western, crime, sci-fi. He belongs in literature, of course. And I think it's, you know, these are phantom barricades, mm-hmm. by and large, mm-hmm. meant to inhibit. Mm-hmm. So I and so many other writers, I feel like it's much more permissible right now than it was 10 years ago, to cross boundaries, to experiment with genre. And if you think about what is the worst of literary fiction, the worst of literary fiction is this. Somebody sips some tea, stares out a window at a roiling bank of clouds, and has an orgasmic epiphany. Right?
All alone.
So, but... the sentences are marvelous, of course.
Yeah.
But what's the worst of genre fiction? Cardboard characters, formulaic plots, and pedestrian writing. But what's the best of genre writing? It's rip-roaring in its energy. It moves. It makes you want to turn the pages so swiftly that it makes a breeze on your face. What's wrong with merging these two territories? Right? Why can't the helicopter explode with pretty sentences?
Ladies and gentlemen, the pitchforks and the torches are in the back. They'll be beginning momentarily. But you've come by this honestly. I mean, every once in a while people will roll their eyes at a literary author who seems to have adopted genre. But the first time I met you, if memory serves, you can correct me if I'm wrong, you were writing about a dwarf who owned a ranch in Oregon and... what was he hunting?
That was one of my failed novels.
It doesn't always work, the breeze in your face.
I had four failed novels in the drawer. That's one of them. And actually, that story had to do with everyone had cameras embedded in their foreheads. And you had this is over 10 years ago. I like to forget that I wrote this. And you could tune into everyone's channel, and so it was an all-observant society. I guess not, it's sort of prescient, I guess, with the whole Google Glasses.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like 10 years of Google Glass, minus the dwarves and the, you know, canyons, right. And everything else. Yeah. But, I mean, the intersection of realism, another one of the earliest stories of yours I read was about a freezer that was bleeding blood, and I remember that was an actual account from one of our friends who you house sat for.
Well, when it comes to writing short stories, people are often asking me, I mean, novels are another thing, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit, but when I'm writing short stories, what I typically do is, you know, I have this cork board next to my desk, and when I sit down, I stare at the cork board for a few minutes in a sort of organic way, and I tack to this cork board all sorts of different things, articles, photographs, 3x5 note cards in which I've scribbled down conversations overheard at parties or diners. And every once in a while, a few things will just glimmer, and I'll realize that they're connected, and they'll appear almost like a constellation. I'll know that they're a story. So I'll have this one thing that's oftentimes the ending, and maybe I'll have another thing in the center, and of course I'll have my opening moment. And then I'm improvising what's in between these things, because part of the joy of storytelling is the act of discovery. I don't want to know everything that's going to occur, but I do have that guide. And Charles Baxter,
my great old mentor,
wise man, and I'm oftentimes quoting him, sometimes not attributing him, but often quoting him. He says that we write to make sense of the widowed images in our lives, and I really love that phrase, widowed images. The idea being that you have these things from the past, these glimmers from the past, and you can't shake them. They're caught up in your imaginative filter for some reason. And oftentimes, those are the things you write to give meaning to. So the opening of a short story of mine, Refresh, Refresh, opens up with these kids in the backyard, and they've made a garden hose tip-to-tip ring in which they box with their gold-colored gloves. And that's true. That's what I used to do as a kid after school. I'd box with my friends. And another story of mine, Swans, it opens up with these young women jumping off of a cliff into a lagoon. And I had that experience when I was 12 years old. I was swimming in this lagoon, and I discovered these teenage girls jumping off of a ledge. And I discovered that with my goggles, if I ducked down in the water, I could see their bikinis torn away when they struck the surface. And so I was, until my fingers pruned up. And that was the opening to a story. And, you know, I've written about this one scene in The Wilding in an essay, and a short story, too, when I was 12 years old. Not 12 years old, I'm sorry. When I was a little bit younger than that, I heard this banshee wail from the forest. We lived on a large 27 acres of woods, and I heard this banshee wail from the forest, and my father came in and invited me out, and he had a rifle, and we followed the noise to the edge of our property, and there we found a deer tangled up in a barbed wire fence, and my father wanted me to kill it. As if killing were like changing a carburetor or tying a tie, and it was sort of a traumatic moment that, you know, I've tried to write about in different scenarios. But the one you're talking about, that image you're talking about, that widowed image you're talking about with the fridge, yeah, Brady Udall, who is the reason I went to grad school. He's a Western writer. He wrote The Miracle Life of Edgar Mint. You might be familiar with that in The Lonely Polygamist. Anyways, I studied under him, and one summer he was away to Utah, and I was watching after his house. So I would go in and I would water his plants, and I would mow his lawn. And I sort of noticed this smell, and I would go back every week, and the smell would grow worse. And finally, I investigated and discovered that there were three lines of blood running down the front of his fridge. It was very, very hot that summer. It was in Southern Illinois, and he's a brilliant writer, but not so. That's smart when
cheap.
It comes to common sense. He's a bit cheap.
he'd save himself some.
He turned down the setting on the freezer and the fridge, thinking that the cold would be magically trapped in it, which was not the case. And I remember walking towards that fridge as though in a horror movie. The handle slowly and opening it, and it just.
Not much.
Tens of thousands of maggots inside. And I cleaned that fridge. I dragged it outside. I cleaned the whole thing.
You're
I had
a
to
good
throw,
grad student.
Throw away my clothes afterwards. And at the end of the summer, he gave me $40.
Nice. But not
if
much
If he had
difference.
Given me a few hundred, I never would have told the story in front of
That's Udall. U-D-A-L-L. Yeah, but not so much difference between the surreal and the real in that situation.
Oh,
right?
Really? You know? I mean, that was borrowing from the tropes of horror. If you look at that story, The Caves in Oregon, it's a literary story published in Glimmer Train, collected in Refresh, Refresh, but the tropes, the archetypes of horror are in there. You've got this cave, there are bats. I read that piece actually at Shaman Drum.
Mm-hmm, I remember.
And Elizabeth Kostova was in the crowd. Felt very nervous reading a bat scene with her in the room, and she's the queen of the bats, you know. And yeah, I think you can look to a lot of my stories, that the so-called literary stories, and see that okay, this is actually a ghost story, though there aren't any ghosts in the in the phantasm sense. This is a ghost story, or this is a monster in the woods story. So I'm borrowing a lot of those conventions, even though somebody might read them and never realize that.
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to do my part with the suspense bit by not talking about the novel yet. How's that working? Good? I'm going to suspend it one just a little bit longer because you mentioned trying to write a similar scene from different genres, different points of view.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of nonfiction recently for Esquire, your contributing editor there. You've the kind of guy who climb up in a tree and spend the night there. You've done a few crazy things. I'd like to talk just a moment, I think we can't not, about the pregnancy suit. Did anyone see this on the Today Show? Was it the Today Show?
It was the Today Show.
Ben, why don't you tell them the story?
Well, I'm sort of a stunt writer when it comes to nonfiction, so I climbed a 250-foot old-growth Douglas fir using a crossbow to get up to the first branch because it's 150 feet up, and I summited in the tree a few times and then spent the night in a hammock. I've jumped out of planes. I've gone hang gliding off of mountains, whitewater rafting. I went on a crazy diet for 21 days where I ate only fruits and vegetables and drank only water, and my body was eating itself during this time.
Did your voice change?
Yeah, that's right. So one of the things, you know, I kind of like the writer in the trenches nonfiction. I don't really do the navel-gazing memoir thing. So I wrote this one piece about getting a vasectomy because I was doing research on the subject, considering getting one, and there was nothing out there except pure biological facts. And I wanted something that could take you through the emotional, psychological experience. So pitched it to GQ, it got picked up and ran, and they got such a response to it. And I still get a ridiculous number of emails about this, mostly from wives.
Well, it was a bit of a play-by-play. And I like whoever was your art director was pretty savvy. The cover image of this is an exploding walnut between a nutcracker.
Well, you should have heard my voice before I got a vasectomy. And there was such a response to this. I think it was one of their most tweeted articles that they wanted to assign me another gender piece.
I think the thing was, the tagline was, honey, read this.
And Donovan Hahn, who lives in Ann Arbor now, he was my editor there, and he came up with this crazy idea. He wanted me to go to Japan to try on this high-tech pregnancy suit. So the idea is that it would be assigned to schools, it would be assigned to hospitals and birthing centers, so that a man could, obviously, this does not come anywhere close to the actual experience, but a man could get some sense of like how it felt physically, and it flutters with movement and stuff.
And it weighs like what?
Well, it gets very heavy, yeah. But I can't complain. I mean, I put it on for a little bit, not for 9 months. And the idea was, really, the hinge behind the article was to write an article about the empathetic man. Because in this day and age, I mean, my grandfather never held a baby. And my father is very proud of the fact that he never changed a diaper in his life. And these days, that's grounds for divorce. And I have a lot of pals who are stay-at-home dads, and I have a lot of pals who are very involved in their kids' lives. And I wanted to address that. And the pregnancy suit became like one jokey sort of way, a stunt way of addressing that. And so... I wore this ridiculous suit and made fun of myself and said how obviously this doesn't even come close to the experience of pregnancy, and it just exploded. And that I was invited onto the Today Show. It was Steve Harvey was the guest host that day. He's a comedian, and you'd think I was like, okay, this will be great, right? It's funny, a guy wearing a pregnancy suit. But I walk onto the set, and Steve Harvey had not read the article,
clearly.
And didn't know who I was at all. Like, I'm not expecting him to know who I am, but to maybe do a little bit of research. And so he just thought I was this really sincere guy who wanted to wear a pregnancy, simulate a pregnancy. And so I started talking, and if you watch the video, he has, it appears that he has a stroke. About 15 seconds in. And he never recovers from it, because I'm doing this, cracking jokes left and right, and he just stares at me. And you're never supposed to have dead time on radio or TV. And the whole set is laughing all, you know, the 40 people you can't see on camera are laughing uproariously, and I think I'm doing great. And then I watched the video later, which was on, you know, there was a headline. The LA Times ran a headline the next day, novelist perplexes Today Show host. I'm not kidding. And Chelsea Handler had it on her show. One of her jokes was that she didn't know that the, you know, the voice of the Witness Protection Program was an actual dude. And anyways, and I got invited on everything after that. I was, you know, late night with Jimmy Fallon, Anderson Cooper. It went on and on and on. I said, no, I was not. I was not going to talk ever again. And I've broken my oath about the stupid pregnancy suit.
Oh, we had to do it. But at one point, he leans across to you and he asks you, "You ever bit a man?"
Yeah. Apropos of nothing. I just.
Yeah, apropos of nothing. Yeah, I don't know. Quite
I thought that there. I said no. I thought there was going to be a gag behind it, but that was it.
Actually, just an honest.
Just wanted to know. I guess I give off that biting vibe.
Now, any good interviewer would know this is a perfect way to segue to your book. All right. So we're going to move now to the novel and talk with you a little bit about that, Ben. But I have one other thing I'd like you to tell me a little bit about, and that is the Werewolf Report.
Yes. When I was in sixth grade, I wrote a research paper titled Werewolves with an exclamation mark. That's how excited I was about the material. I say research paper with quotation marks around it. But it had a table of contents that was only 5 pages long, and the final section was titled The Ceremony of the Wolf. And I studied all of this, what I could find in the library, and there was this one mottled leather tome that told me how to become a werewolf. And so I, in a backyard, under a full moon, I tried to become a werewolf. And in a few days here, it's going to be a full moon.
And your dad said, "Put your damn kids' clothes on, kid. Get back in here."
But anyways, it just goes to show you the, you know, the seriousness with which I took the werewolf legacy. And you know, I received a B- on this paper, which is one of the many reasons it feels so good to say, you know, to hold this book in my hand and say, "In your face, Mrs. Ziegenhagen."
So 2 decades later, this stirs in you. We won't be hugging it out later. Let's talk about the origins of this book. You've written 2 well-received story collections prior to this. 1 Plimpton Prize as Best American Short Stories, another well-received novel. Also a suspenseful element to it, Wilding. What was the first flicker of this book? Where did you first glimpse it or start to catch sight of the story that it might become?
Well, let me say too that a lot of my work has had the genre edited out of it. So if you look at Refresh, Refresh as an example of that, that's probably the story that I'm most well known for, is my breakout story in the Paris Review. That piece, I initially had the boys becoming their fathers. They literally transformed by the end into their fathers. The Wilding was a monster. It was not a bear. It was actually a creature in the woods. And that was changed. And so I guess I finally arrived at the point where I was like, I'm just going to go all out and do what I want to do. And I was thinking at that time about what we fear right now. Because some of my favorite fantasy stories, some of the most resonant fantasy stories, are channeling cultural unease. I mean, you can think of ridiculous examples too, like Godzilla and how it came out of the post-atomic era. You can think of great literature like Frankenstein and how it takes a knife to the nerve of the moment, the way that everyone's anxieties about science and technology, everyone's anxieties about man playing God are manifested in the creature. You can look at the example of the Red Scare and McCarthyism and how it gave rise to Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You can look at George Romero's work and how he reinvented the zombie era for every, you know, for the civil rights movement, for the rise of consumerism in the 80s, for Cold War anxieties. You can look at the slew of apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic narratives that have come out since 9/11. So I was thinking about that. I was thinking about what we fear right now. And what we fear is twofold. Most of all, we fear infection, look at the Purell oozing from every countertop in every business in America. Look at the way that headlines about swine flu and bird flu and West Nile dominate headlines. And we fear terrorism. In the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing is this most recent sad reminder of this. I mean, terror, Stephen King says terror is the most powerful of all emotions. And sadly, he's right. Like, terror can own us by the millions, can paralyze us by the millions. And so I braided those two things together. And I came up with this idea for what I guess you could call a post-9/11 reinvention of the werewolf myth. So that was the initial seed of the idea.
So then what about research? How did you begin prying open the lid on these different elements?
Well, the first thing I did was, you know, when I'm building a novel, what I do is I moved into a new old house recently, and the previous owner was a photographer, a hobby photographer, and he has this closet off of what's now my office that he uses as a dark room, and I use the dark room for other purposes. So I rip off of my kids, Melissa and Doug Arneasel, 10-foot scrolls of paper, and I tack them up on the wall for different projects. And I begin on the left side, usually sketching out characters. So I have this idea, this larger idea about the post-9/11 reinvention of the werewolf myth. And then I start to build characters. And sometimes I'm actually drawing them. I'm writing Wikipedia entries, I guess you could say, about them. And then I start to figure out what they desire. And when I figure out what they want, I try to figure out obstacles to get in the way of that desire. And those are the first stirrings of plot. And then I've got this plot growing across this scroll of paper. And once I figure that out, what I start to do is I sketch over the top of this with pencil, of course, because everything's going to change once I actually start to write. Over the top of this, I sketch what looks like a cardiogram or a seismograph. It's what I call a suspense-o-meter. And what I'm trying to figure out are the spikes and the valleys. When do I have a moment of high action or an action sequence of several scenes stacked together? When do I have a moment of repose? And I'm trying to be as strategic as possible about this arrangement, this larger orchestration of suspense. And so I'm moving things around according to this suspense-o-meter. So as I'm doing this, and I'm thinking about these projects sometimes a year in advance of actually hitting the keyboard, while I'm doing this, I'm also doing the research. And every story I write is a research project. This is one of the things I do with my students when I'm teaching a class. I force them to have a research component, oftentimes connected to work. It's amazing how many stories I see where the character seemingly has no job. And we spend the majority of our lives, right, at the desk or in the assembly line at the factory or driving back and forth between our home and work. And so giving the character a job, like I wrote a story about a taxidermist, and I didn't just fake it. I went into a taxidermy place, and I spent a week with them, eavesdropping, clacking the glass eyeballs around in my palm, sniffing the formaldehyde and stroking the polyurethane forms. And then, you know, doing as much research as I could when it comes to Google or when it comes to library archives. And so in this book, there were so many things I did not know. And I had to speak with politicians. I had to speak with brewmasters. I had to speak with soldiers. And I had several students and friends who were former soldiers, and I was able to get from one of them the Marine Corps guidebook, which really helped with battle formations and strategy and just the insider lingo that can be so useful in giving you credibility. The thing I did not know the most about, though, was the science behind infection, mutation, vaccination. So I don't know how familiar you are with Ames, Iowa. There is no reason you should know anything about it, except that the USDA labs and Iowa State University are located there. And let me tell you that Ames, Iowa is ground zero for the apocalypse.
Is that why you left your job there?
One of many reasons. And the USDA labs have four security posts, several layers of barbed wire and fencing before you can get into them. It's level 4 security clearance. There's guys with assault rifles walking around. And this is every ugly thing imaginable is in that building. And what I love is that right across the street is a daycare. So, you know, they've got all these animals that are wandering around. They have several hundred acres. And they're, you know, they're like drilling open bison skulls and putting stuff in the bison and seeing what happens. And they're all wandering around, and there's all these crows that come down and land in the fields, and they get up and say, this can't be a good idea.
Go land on the teeter-totter.
Exactly. So anyways, I work out with these guys at the gym. And so, you know, they're not supposed to talk about what goes on in there. But I'd be spotting one of them on the bench, and, you know, they'd be struggling on that last rep, and I'm like, so we're going to talk about this, right? And I was able to sit down with them, and I was able to sit down with researchers at Iowa State University who specialize in animal-borne pathogens in order to figure out the slippery science behind this disease. Prions, you already know a little bit about them from mad cow disease, from chronic wasting disease. Scientists don't know much about them. And I was advised to pursue this as the best possibility for the scenario. So they suspect that many cases of dementia are actually prion infections. So in this case, I filled up, 12 legal tablets, yellow legal tablets or something, talking to all of these people and figuring out the way that this could conceivably affect the human mind, target the mind, and influence everything from sexual rage to impulsivity. I mean, sexual impulsivity and rage and just somebody whose id was unchained, because that's why people connect to the werewolf myth. They connect to the vampire myth because the vampire myth is aspirational. Everybody wants to live forever. And there's something very sexual about vampires in the way that they sneak into open windows at night, and you know, people are always arching their backs and gasping when bitten, right? So even though you might have corpse breath, everybody wants to be a vampire.
Maybe that's the arc.
Right. But the werewolf is not aspirational. Nobody wants to be hairier. Nobody wants to be out of control, but we all can connect to the werewolf myth in the way that due to rage, due to exhaustion, due to too much to drink, due to drugs, due to whatever, we've all come unleashed. And sometimes this happens when the shades are down. And this is what Jekyll and Hyde is all about. I would say that is, you know, it's interesting to look at, like, the vampire myth, and the foundational text is, you could say, Dracula, the creature, story is Frankenstein, ghost story, turn of the screw. But the foundational text for the werewolf myth is Jekyll and Hyde. And it's really about that. It's about the wildness that is barely caged in all of us. And so I wanted to come up with a medical reason for this. And in doing so, it becomes not just biologically feasible, physiologically feasible, but it becomes a political allegory.
You're listening to IPR News Radio. Coming up, Benjamin Percy reads from his novel Red Moon. That's in part two, right here on Interlochen Public Radio.
Listening to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We return to Jeremy Chamberlain's conversation with Benjamin Percy, author of The Wilding and the new novel Red Moon.
I think what's so interesting about the book as well is that it isn't a book about people who have suddenly go up on hind legs and get hairier and sprout. It's very much about what you're describing, this sort of ego and id. Did you have some issues, though? I mean, were you ever challenged, or did you just not even think about this, about how do I sort of honor this while still making it my own? Because there is these long histories of these trends and genres, and do you see any sort of responsibility to that?
Sure. I mean, I wanted to tip my hat to the genre, but reinvent it. And part of that reinvention was coming up with this feasible situation for infection and mutation, And another part of it was doing small sleight of hand tricks like not calling them werewolves, never using that word
right.
in the entire novel. You know, there's no connection to the full moon either. It's a disease. And if you look at The Passage by Justin Cronin, he's doing something similar there. The word vampire never appears in there. And if you look at The Walking Dead, written by Robert Kirkman and now made into the popular series on AMC, the word zombie never shows up. They're walkers, right? And it's just, you know, everyone wants to follow that writing maxim, make it new. Why is this story being told if it's been told before? So I wanted to make sure that people felt like they were in fresh real estate.
Do you feel
my own 40 acres.
Your own 40 acres? Do you feel, I mean, to go push that a little bit further, George Orwell said that he thought the only writing worth writing was political. John Gardner is famous for preaching about the morality of fiction and what it needs to do.
Yeah.
We often dismiss genre work for being fanciful, despite the fact, if you look back at, you know, the science fiction from the Russians and the Czech, these are all allegories about communism and fascism.
Right.
Do you feel, ironically, more responsibility writing a book like this? I mean, do you think it's a writer's responsibility to be political? Do you see this as a political novel?
Oh, yeah, it's a very political novel. And I've written many political stories in the past, too. And it's a risky thing. When you write a political story, the danger is becoming polemical. Mm-hmm. The danger is becoming editorial. And if somebody suspects that you have some sort of editorial message behind your fiction, they don't believe in the characters. They become puppets for some larger message. And you have written an after-school special. So, how can you be political without being polemical? One of the ways I try to handle this is a story like Refresh, Refresh. I'm tackling a hot-button topic in there. And it's the war in Iraq. And I set off with the express purpose of writing about the war in Iraq because at that time in 2005, I had read article after article and seen news report after news report about the war, but I'd read no fiction. There's been many stories since then. But at that time, I'd read no fiction. So I wanted to address it in some way because I was bothered by the fact, in part because I was bothered by the fact that there'd be an ambush and 14 soldiers would die, and that was buried in a sidebar column on page 16 or something. And then on the front page, there'd be news about Paris Hilton's latest exploits. You know, it's just sort of way to make people, force people to address the issue, but not in a way that bullied them. My message was not that war was good or war was bad, but this is war instead, and this is how war can infect the home front. And so when I was writing about this, you know, I want people to see parallels to 9/11, but I want people to see beyond that parallels to our entire human history in the way that we fear the other and we marginalize the other. And in that way, this book bears more resemblance to the X-Men than it does Twilight, right? It has that Orwellian quality where a certain segment of the population, because they are different, are being punished, and they're forced to sort of lose their identity.
I'll ask you one last question about this book. What was the biggest surprise you encountered during the writing process? What's the one thing that you couldn't have guessed when you sat down to write this book?
Well, people have referred to this book as a departure for me, and from what we've already talked about, that's not the case. I've been thinking about these sorts of scenarios. I've been drawing in archetypes of genre, the tropes of genre, all along. It is a departure for me, though, in this sense. It's an epic novel. And when I was first starting off, I referred to those four failed novels that I wrote. I was convinced for a long time that I was going to be a short story writer, that I was best suited for the sprint and not the marathon. And the novel that I was able to sell finally, The Wilding, was a negotiation between the short and the long form, in that The Wilding is essentially, well, I played to my strengths. I was like, I'm making all these mistakes. I need to make the leap from short stories to novel in a more strategic way. So it's in a one place, and it takes place over one weekend, and it has a small cast of characters, and in a way, it's more like three novellas woven together. And so I thought, all right, I've done it now. But then the novel that I've always felt is most appealing, that has swept me away, that has taken hold of my mind for weeks on end, and that I feel like the characters still live with me to this day, and I still sometimes wonder what's going on with them, is the epic. And I never thought I would be capable of writing an epic, and my editor forced me to, because when I pitched Red Moon, I had 85 pages and an outline for a trilogy, and my editor said, I want this as one epic novel, which seemed impossible to me at the time. And I was able to figure out structurally how to write a novel in the same way that I figured out back in grad school structurally how to write a short story. And that is through repeated readings and through sort of the same strategy a mechanic might have in looking under the hood. So early on in grad school, I was having trouble with structure. And what I would do is I would read a Flannery O'Connor story, who I felt really tackled structure well. I would read a Flannery O'Connor story five times. And the sixth time, I would go through that story, and I would outline it paragraph by paragraph to figure out how it was put together. Paragraph A, theme introduced through description of weather. Paragraph B, character A introduced as jerk through dialogue, whatever. And I would go through that, and then I would try to write a story that built off of that outline but bore no resemblance to the original. And I did that two or three times, and then I figured it out. I figured out how to write a short story. And then I'd never done that with a novel. And so when I was writing this, I was like, I need to study up. And I read a bunch of monstrous thrillers. I read The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which at the time, everyone was reading. I would walk through an airport, everybody had that book in their hand. And I wanted to figure out why. And I'm still wondering in part why, but there are some, it is great about the way it sprinkles these clues all throughout, these things that keep you wanting more. And it helped me understand. I went through with a yellow legal tablet, I mapped that entire novel out. And I figured out this larger diagram of both the mystery and the way information was withheld and the high action sequences and how they are balanced. And then I borrowed some of those techniques and somehow accomplished like a novel that is a brick, like several old-growth forests have been pulped to make, you know, make up for that volume they held in your hand. But my hope is that it never slows down, that it's like a hail of silver bullets that you can't stop reading.
Well, thank you, Ben. I want to. There's a lot of questions I'd like to ask you. I'd like to ask you about wrestling John Irving. I'd like to ask you about your sister who taught at the Interlochen Arts Academy as writer-in-residence and is a fantastic writer herself and has an amazing book coming out next year about infiltrating a cult, a nonfiction book, and about her crazy experiences with bats. I have one last question that I'm going to ask you to read something from your book, and it's this. I was wondering... I should do it in your voice.
If you were in a 12 by 12 by 12 foot steel cage, barred, if you were in that cage and you were naked, what is the largest animal you could fight and kill?
Very good question.
You'll have to read the book to find out.
I would fight a lion, an eagle, and a shark so that I could be the king of the jungle and the sky and the sea.
Bravo. It's a brilliant book. I thought it was fantastic. Thank you very much for our conversation. We're going to have questions from the audience in just a moment, but in Ben's real voice, not my imitation of Ben's voice, I'd like you to hear a little bit of his work.
Okay. This is one of those summit moments I was talking about before when it comes to the suspensometer. One of the peaks. Claire does not know what is happening outside right this minute as the small brigade of vehicles, the armored vans, the black sedans with government plates appear at the end of her block with their headlights off. She lives in a wooded neighborhood, each house set back on a half-acre lot. There are no streetlights, no sidewalk. The vehicles purr to a stop. Their doors swing open but do not close. Any noise that might bring Claire to the window, the stomp of boots along the asphalt, The clatter of assault rifles and ammunition clips is muffled by the steady snowfall, a white shroud thrown over the night. She does not know about the tall man in the black suit and black necktie, his skull as hairless as a stone, who stands next to his black Lincoln town car. She does not know that he has his hands tucked into his pockets, or that snow is melting against his scalp and dripping down his face, or that he is smiling slightly. She does not know that her father and mother are sitting at the kitchen table, drinking their way through a bottle of Merlot, not holding, but squeezing each other's hands in reassurance as they watch CNN, the coverage of what the president called a coordinated terror attack directed at the heart of America. So she does not know that when the front door kicks open, splintering along its hinges, her father is holding the remote in his hand, a long black remote that could be mistaken for a weapon. She does not know that he stands up so suddenly his chair tips over and clatters to the floor, that he screams no and holds out his hand, the hand gripping the remote, and points it at the men as they come rushing through the entryway, the dark rectangle of night, with snow fluttering around them like damp shredded paper. She only knows when she hears the crash, the screams, the rattle of gunfire, that she must run. She hasn't changed often, only a handful of times. Not only because it is forbidden, because she could be jailed for it, but because she doesn't like the way it makes her feel, so grotesquely other. And bruised for days afterward, her body sudden shifting, like the growing pains that make children twist under the sheets and cry out at night. She can smell the men now, deodorant and aftershave, cigarettes and gum, gun oil, the sulfur of their weapons' discharge. She can hear their harsh breathing, their voices calling out clear from different corners of the house. She can feel their footsteps pounding up the stairs toward her. Her skin itches horribly, as if bubbling over with hives, and then the hair bristles from it in a rush. Her gums recede and her teeth grind together in a mouth not yet big enough for them. Her bones stretch and bend and pop, and she yowls in pain, as if she is giving birth, one body coming out of another. She always cries, tears of blood. This time her tears and mewling come from the pain, and also the dawning realization that everything, in an instant, has changed. But these thoughts are fleeting. The wolf in her has no time for them. Her mind sharpens to a singular focus. Survival is what matters. There is nothing else, no love or sadness or fear or worry, only a needle stab of adrenaline that surges through her, sends her loping toward the window, toward the reflection she barely recognizes, hunched and misshapen and growing larger by the second. Then she crashes through herself, through the window. The glass shatters, and shards of it bite at her. There is no roof to scuttle across, no lattice or gutter to climb down. There is instead the blackness of the night, the emptiness of the air she falls through, flipping and twisting as the wind shrieks in her ears and the ground rushes up to meet her. Splinters of glass mixed up with snow sparkle all around her. 2 inches have already fallen, but that isn't enough to cushion a fall from a second-story window. She lands on all fours, rolling and thudding forward, sliding across the short expanse of lawn, smearing away the snow in a ragged teardrop to reveal the green grass beneath. A tree at the edge of the lawn offers a hammer blow to her chest. Her breath is gone. Her wrist blazes. The night seems to close upon her for a moment. And then she draws in a sucking gasp. Her window throws a square of light broken up by triangles and hexagons of yellow and orange that spotlight her body. The spotlight blackened a moment later when the men charge into her room and pursue her exit. She shakes away the pain and leaps to her feet and sees the man, the tall man in the black suit. 20 yards away, he observes her with his head cocked curiously. And then he begins to walk and then run, his long arms slashing the air toward her. Thanks.
I have to say, I think that was the best Ben Percy imitation I've ever heard. Thanks for putting it on for us. All right, we've got some microphones in the back, people moving around. Who would like to be the first to ask Ben a question? Got somebody here in the back?
That was really awesome. I liked that verse. I'm Ryan. I'm a student of Interlochen Arts Academy. I would just like to know, how deep was your voice when you were a teenager?
If you can imagine me at 14 years old, I weighed maybe 75 pounds and was this tall, but spoke like this. And it was kind of awkward, I have to say. It's a little bit like in Jurassic Park, people have joked, when the T-Rex is coming toward the car and the glass, it trembles, the water trembles in it as the T-Rex approaches. It's more felt than heard. It was 14. I was born with these sideburns, though.
So I have a really strange question. I read The Wilding just before you got here, so yeah. I could understand and see if I wanted to come here tonight. And I did.
That's a good sign she came.
It is, and it was such a great read. It was so fast and so furious. But I have a really bizarre question. So I'm still trying to get my head around the owls in that book. And I really, what do they symbolize, or are they just sort of this interruption mechanism? So what were you thinking when you wrote about the owls in The Wilding?
Well, it's one of those widowed images I was talking about before, in that my uncle had a cabin and birds kept, he didn't have a chimney top, and the birds kept going there to roost for the heat, and then they would pass out and fall down the chimney into the fire, and then on fire they would end up, you know, blasting through his living room, smoking feathers. And one time an owl dropped down. So I had to use that image, and I wrote one of my other failed novels is called The Mystery Light, and it took place in the UP. It had to do with the Paulding Light. And I had the owls in there. And it was one of those things that I have, and this, any writers in the room, this helped me with revision. What I came to develop is, you've heard the phrase, kill your darlings, Faulkner's phrase, kill your darlings. It's so hard to kill your darlings sometimes, especially when you're drafting and you have draft 7, draft 14, draft 30. You know that whatever you're cutting from draft 7 or 10, whatever you're cutting from that, you're probably not going to be able to find again. If you decide later, oh, I really like that description of a mountain. Where was that? So what I did is I created a graveyard folder. And probably you're less morbid than I am. You can call it the compost pile. It's the same idea. And every time I cut something from a story, not only do I save a new draft, but I go to the graveyard folder. And inside of the graveyard folder, there's all these files that look like tombstones. And they have names like descriptions of nature, first lines, scenes of dialogue, whatever. And I'll wander through the graveyard whenever I start a new story and say hi to some old friends. And then, put some fresh flowers out. And then I'll decide, I could use that kidney and this toe and that eyeball. And I call down the lightning and bring them back to life in the next project. And the owls were one of those things. And what they come to symbolize in the book, I it's not too heavy-handed, I hope. I mean, they're just part of the plot and serve as an interruption, as you say, but they also they come to symbolize death in various ways. Sometimes a physical death, sometimes an emotional death.
Thank you. That talk was really amazing. I have kind of a logistical question about the research that you said you do, both for my students and for myself.
Yeah.
I think my question is along the lines of, I know being Benjamin Percy, it's probably a little bit easier if they don't know you to give a resume and be like, I'd like to work with you or talk to you about the work that you do for this novel. But for folks who are starting out, like, I guess I wanted to ask how you initially started doing that. Like, mm-hmm. What's the protocol around asking someone to help you with your writing project?
Well, I learned very early on when I was working at the Brown Daily Herald, the college newspaper, the university newspaper, that, you know, I had to go out and bug people. I had to knock on doors and I had to call them up. I remember doing an interview with an undertaker back then, a mortician for an article I was doing for the paper. And people are always, they love to talk to you, generally. They're eager to talk to you, to tell their stories. I've done this since I was 19, since I was 20, when my resume didn't really have much on it. And I've done things like, I wait for the mail. When I was writing The Mystery Light, one of the characters was a mailman, and so I just waited for the mailman to come.
I'm sure that wasn't troubling to him.
And I was like, hey, can I follow you around all day? I'm writing this book, and he was like, sure, come on. Got in the truck, and we drove around Milwaukee, and yeah, he shared all these stories with me, and I got all the behind-the-scenes stuff. And same thing with the taxidermist. You know, I just knock on the door, I'm like, hey, dudes, can I hang out? Like, come on in. You know, as long as you're doing the work for free, like helping them out a bit, yeah. And as long as they sense that you're not there to expose them in some capacity, as long as you have, you know, good, you're interested questions, you're not talking down to them, you're like sincerely interested in their work, like they're excited. It makes them feel valued.
Hi, you talked a couple of times about your four failed novels.
Yeah.
Now that you've become who you are, do you think you might dust those off and do something else with those?
No. I mean, I'm very glad that I wrote them. They were necessary failures. And I have harvested some things from the graveyard, from them. But they're going to stay in the drawer. In fact, I need to delete those files. I don't want to have a Salinger. Have you heard about Salinger? Yeah. Has all this posthumous work coming out? Like, that scares me. I don't want the dwarf coming back.
The camera.
Well, folks, you've been a fantastic audience, and we can't thank you enough for coming tonight and supporting this great program.
Thank you.
That was Benjamin Percy at the National Writers Series, talking with Jeremy Chamberlain. Percy is the author of two collections of short stories and the novels Red Moon and The Wilding. The next program from the National Writers Series features Michael Paternity in conversation with author and Writers Series founder Doug Stanton. Paternity's latest book, The Telling, is equal parts mystery, memoir, travelogue, and storytelling. The event takes place September 27th at the Traverse City Opera House and will later be broadcast on this station. The Michael Paternity event also kicks off a four-day festival called Storyfest 2013, featuring fiction and poetry workshops and conversations with great authors. You can find out more about the National Writers Series and Storyfest at nationalwritersseries.org. I'm Linnea Melkarrick, and this is Interlochen Public Radio.